Good evening. Welcome once again to One Step Beyond, the Bay Area's most controversial political talk show. Perhaps the most controversial political talk show in the entire country at this stage of the game, in and of itself not saying very much, given how uncontroversial so many things are these days. People are given to talking about very bland things, and the very unbland things that are going on, unfortunately, do not receive the attention that they are due. This evening, we're going to have a lot of very disturbing information to present. We're going to be talking, we're going to have our Italian translator, Dave, call in and right around 7:15, and he's going to present some very, very disturbing information. And then the rest of the program will take off on that note, so to speak. Tonight's show, as well as next week's, are going to go into the archives. So those of you who are interested in preserving information for posterity's sake or whatever are strongly advised to tape tonight's broadcast. Now, in general, if you are tuned in for the first time or one of the first times, you are undoubtedly going to find a lot of the things that are said on this broadcast startling, as I said before, controversial, perhaps outrageous, perhaps incredible. That is understood. This is a different kind of program. Those of you who find yourselves moved to skepticism or contempt or whatever, again, a healthy skepticism is welcomed in the context of this broadcast. You are encouraged, however, to reserve your editorial comment until after you've had a chance to do a couple of things. First of all, listen over a period of time and see how many of the topics of discussion bear out in the manner that they are discussed on this broadcast. Beyond that, I strongly encourage those of you who find some of the information that is presented here to be ridiculous or whatever, to get a hold of what we call archive shows. That is a particular form of documentary in which myself and my usual co-host, Nip Tuck, who should be back in a week or two when he's finished with his literary duties, we basically read information on the air. Okay, good. We've got Dave on line three. We read information on the air for the purpose of taping, specifically because the arguments that are presented on this broadcast are based upon documentation, secondary and once in a while primary sources. The listeners to this broadcast are encouraged strongly to tape these programs off the air, or if you miss a broadcast, or if you are tuned in very recently, you can order the archive shows from a tape duplication service. I will give you the name of that service now. It's called Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023. That's in San Francisco, and the zip code is 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. Write or phone to the attention of Paul, and again, neither myself nor Nip Tuck, the usual co-host of this show, nor this station gets any money out of this arrangement. We have Dave here on the phones, and we'll be getting to him here in just a second. Okay, good evening, Dave. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I have kind of a short break tonight because we're shorthanded here.
Okay, well, you're on right now, so why don't, as briefly as you can, due to the limitations of time, why don't you give us the two pieces of news that you gave me this past week. First of all, tell the listeners the good news, I guess you could say, about that nail that was driven into the tire of your car.
Well, good news is I don't work at that location anymore, so that isn't liable to happen.
Okay, well, I think it's worth describe the situation real briefly, though. I think it's important.
Well, I worked in an area of San Jose where skinheads are frequent and recruit other members. And a few months prior to the nail incident, I'd been ID'd by a skinhead who followed me through the mall and asked me if I like skinheads or not, to which I replied, only if they're not Nazis. And that kind of put him off. And then one night I came out, and this was in June, and a car pulled up, screeched from in front of the theaters, which is a parallel to the exit to my store, and tried to hit me down, and I do have a witness to that, who's another employee who was exiting the store at the same time I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that, I had a giant nail in my tire. It was not the kind of nail that you would find on the road in a piece of wood. This was obviously put there deliberately. It was the kind of nail that if you ran over it, your car would go flat in a few feet.
Hmm. So, in other words, there is no possibility that that nail could have gotten in there accidentally.
No, it's too big. It's so big it looks like a drill spike or something.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of harassment that researchers in this field receive. I describe that as good news because if that's all that happens to a researcher in this field, you can consider yourself pretty lucky. Due to the limitations of time, Dave, why don't you then give us the bad news about what happened to your friend Janet Walker?
On October 7th, which is the day of May's funeral,
mm-hmm.
a friend of mine in San Francisco, an intelligent a young woman who reads many of the publications May recommends, she's an admirer of May's, always talked about her and admired her.
Did she listen to the broadcast?
I'm pretty sure she did on and off. It's a little hard to get it up in the city, but she did as much as possible.
Okay.
Now, in the afternoon of Friday, October 7th, she was last seen in her upstairs apartment waiting for get on a plane to Indiana. She had everything packed up and sent, ahead of time, she had all her suitcases in her room packed, so her room was empty except for suitcases. She had all her money from her account was there, and her one-way ticket, and
mm-hmm.
that's the last time anyone saw her.
Have the authorities been contacted? In other words, have
I'm
people...
I'm not sure if they have or not. I've been, talking to friends. We've been coordinating the distribution and posting of flyers with her latest picture on the front.
Mm-hmm.
They're up in the Haight-Ashbury, where she lived, and they're also in the Santa Cruz area, where she used to live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would think that it would be an excellent idea, in fact, mandatory at this point, to notify the police, because this does not sound good, and there's an ominous... The fact that it happened the day of May's funeral is ominous to me, because there was... There were some interesting factors at May's funeral, which I don't necessarily want to discuss at this time.
And also another mysterious thing. Janet had no known enemies. She was a very pleasant person to talk to, very friendly. She didn't hang out with bad crowds of people, no drugs, no drinking. Just a conservative kind of a lifestyle. She was security conscious. Although she didn't drive, she walked very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Rode
mm-hmm.
along very quickly. Looked all around her. Very security conscious. Not the kind of person who would jump into a stranger's car or even be lured into one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very mysterious.
Yeah, that is more than mysterious. I'm afraid it may turn out to be tragic. Having a desparecido, and this was someone you knew socially.
Yes, that's right.
Basically, it sounds as though she has become an American desparecido.
I know. That same thought struck me. It's just so mysterious. Her friends are just in shock over it.
Yeah, one of the things that scares me, too, is the fact that this was the day of May's funeral. There were a couple of reported satanic links or connections to people at the funeral, which I can't confirm, and until that's confirmed... But it will go into the category of food for thought and grounds for further research. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of these cults would associate the burial of the funeral service of a prominent researcher and enemy, obviously, of theirs, like Mae Brussels, with a time to perform some sort of blood sacrifice. Just one of the first thoughts that occurred to me is that perhaps she'd been kidnapped and will be used in some sort of god-awful ritual during Halloween, which is one of the major satanic festivals. And this against the background of... May's work and my work on satanic cults as fronts for intelligence activity by the National Security Establishment.
And I forgot one more thing. Her room was found that night when her parents called up a friend of hers and told him that she was not at the airport in Indiana. So her friend went into her room, and all he found was all the luggage in the same place he'd seen it in the afternoon. All the money was still there in the same place. And that's it. So all she had was her ID, her California ID, and perhaps a small purse or a shoulder bag. It's really odd that a person would vanish with all their money and all their suitcases and their ticket left just as it was in her room.
Well, obviously, it's more than a little strange. I think it's frankly sinister, and I definitely think the next step for you and Janet Walker's friends, and perhaps for the listeners to this program, is to contact the police. I don't think there's a moment to be lost. As I say, one possibility that occurs to me, and this is just, you know, an offhand thought, is that perhaps she was kidnapped and is going to be used during some kind of Halloween ritual, because that is the time, it's one of the satanic holidays. And again, in the context of this broadcast, for people that are unfamiliar with our arguments, we're not talking about the devil per se. We're talking about satanic cults as fronts for intelligence activity, and specifically using these things as Nazi cells. So I think that might be one area in which they could pursue.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get going, Dave.
Okay.
That's just one in a series of things that this is about the worst that's ever happened.
Well, you can't get...
doing research.
Yeah, well, listen, Dave, keep up the good work. Keep a stiff upper lip, you know. Be careful. Take care of yourself. Certainly we all value the magnificent work you're doing and you yourself as an individual human being. I will stay in touch. And illegitimi non carborundum, as they say. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Dave. And, well, there you have it. Democracy in action. And again, we're not talking now about El Salvador, we're not talking about Guatemala, we're talking about right here in the U.S. of A. And that is going to serve as a lead-in to the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. I'm not going to give you the usual rundown. This broadcast, and it will be continued next week because I do want to get some phone calls for at least the last hour of the program, is going to consist of a rundown of some, just some, of the suspicious deaths and probable assassinations or possible assassinations that have occurred in this country of relatively minor figures during the last 8 years or so, the Reagan years. And also some during the closing month or two of the Carter administration. Something that people, I think, should think about is the fact that as they go about their daily activities, society is changing very, very quickly around them. This is no longer the same country it was 8 years ago. There's an excellent article, for example, that is changing the mode slightly here. There's an excellent article in today's San Francisco Sunday Chronicle Examiner talking about a new book that's come out which discusses the phenomenal hold that Japan now has over the U.S. economy. In 1980, only one of the world's eight largest banks was Japanese. Now the world's 10 largest banks are Japanese. And this is not to be racist or xenophobic or anti-Nisei or Japanese or anything else, but to note, in the context of Japanese reaction, and Japan is moving to the right and rather quickly, apparently, that the United States is in a fundamentally different situation than it was when Reaganomics took over. The United States is now the world's biggest debtor nation. From the end of World War I through 1980, it was the world's biggest creditor nation. Only the name has remained the same. Everything else has changed. And this is by way of pointing out to those of you in the listening audience who are not yet active in some capacity. Many of you are. Many of you are calling radio stations like we ask you to. You are writing letters to the editors of your newspapers and doing things of that kind, doing research, sending in articles, and God bless you for it. But regrettably, there are still many of you who are sitting doing nothing. And those of you who are simply going about your business are changing very, very quickly to remain inactive, to remain as one has been when society is changing so dramatically and so terribly around you, is to change. It's to change in a very profound and evil fashion. The situation for an American citizen now is precisely the same as the situation of a citizen in early Nazi Germany. To simply sit and do nothing is to render oneself profoundly evil. And I think, well, as you listen to the articles that I'm going to read this evening, I think you might want to reflect on just how close to home things like this are going to get before some of you get up off your rear ends and get busy. Tonight, I haven't even organized tonight's broadcast to the same extent that I have in the past. What I'm going to be doing is read a sort of a loose, random downloading, or almost random downloading, of some of the suspicious deaths and probable assassinations that have occurred in this country of relatively minor figures over the course of the last 8 years. Tonight's broadcast and next week's are going to go into the archives under the title of The Hit Parade. We'll lead off with an article that a number of people sent in, this from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, October 11th of 1988. This is a UPI story. Dateline Stratford, Vermont headline, Samuel A. Adams. It's an obituary. Samuel A. Adams, 55, a CIA analyst who accused his superiors and Army General William Westmoreland of manipulating Vietnam War intelligence estimates, was found dead, apparently of a heart attack, in his home yesterday. Adams charged in the late 1960s that rigged data on Viet Cong strength was designed to mislead President Lyndon Johnson about the course of the war. The charges formed the basis for a celebrated libel suit filed against CBS News by Westmoreland, which was eventually settled out of court. Adams' account of the controversy is contained in his book, Who the Hell Are We Fighting Out There?, to be published by W.W. Norton of New York. Adams, the CIA expert on the Viet Cong, contended that Westmoreland's military intelligence officers had been ordered to deliberately underestimate Viet Cong's strength to make it appear that the American-backed war was being won by South Vietnam. After making formal objections within the CIA, Adams submitted evidence that the Viet Cong had at least 30,000 more soldiers than reported by Westmoreland. The objections by Adams were noted in a national intelligence estimate that was placed on Johnson's desk the same week as the 1968 Tet Offensive. Viet Cong forces, in numbers far larger than Westmoreland had reported, mounted surprise attacks that overwhelmed cities and villages throughout South Vietnam and almost breached defenses at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. The dispute over Viet Cong's strength had been a major controversy at the CIA, where Adams worked for 10 years. Adams had contended that then-CIA Director Richard Helms knew that Westmoreland had rigged Viet Cong statistics. Adams also tried, but failed, to institute court-martial proceedings against Westmoreland. The Adams controversy was the foundation for a CBS News documentary which resulted in the libel suit against the network by Westmoreland. Note the first paragraph. Samuel A. Adams, 55, a CIA analyst who accused his superiors and Army General William Westmoreland of manipulating Vietnam War intelligence estimates, was found dead, apparently of a heart attack, in his home yesterday. One of the things we've discussed at considerable length on this program is the long-standing and successful efforts by the U.S. National Security Establishment, including CIA, to perfect means of assassination which would mimic natural death. Apparent heart attack, apparent stroke, cancer, as we discussed last week in connection with the death and probable assassination of Mae Brussel. And there are other things as well. Apparent suicides. Well, one of the favorites is you walk up to somebody, so go see the movie 3 Days of the Condor. You hold a gun to their head, you walk them around the corner, then you pull the trigger, wipe off the gun, wipe fingerprints off the gun, and place it in their hand. There are other variations on that theme. There are a lot of ways of getting rid of somebody in such a way as to make it appear to be an accident. And at the conclusion of next week's prepared portion, at the conclusion of the two parts of the hit parade, we will read a very important and chilling memorandum which will document these efforts at perfecting means of clandestine murder. A chilling article was sent in by a listener. This is from the DX Listening Digest, issue 16, closing date September 8, 1987. This is edited and published by Glenn Hauser of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. This is a shortwave listener's publication. And we find the following information in here. The shocking and untimely death of Ron Schatz prompts me to publish the following without delay. I had an extremely interesting and lengthy conversation with Ron at AnnerCon. I guess that's a shortwave listener's convention or organization. He said some of his new info on Radio Cayman would appear in the September WRTH newsletter. Ron had been vigorously researching a number of factors related to this station, still heard nightly with booming signal on 9960. It is the most mysterious of the Latin American clandestine stations. There's a lot of shortwave terminology in here, and so you'll have to bear with me as I struggle with it. For dozens of months now, its Nat King Cole and Radio Cayman programming have held forth on 31, formerly 41 meters. During that time, no DXers have established a QSL address for the station or even reliable speculation on who is responsible for the station's programming. For many months, Ron Schatz had been in contact with a number of his sources in the anti-Castro community of Miami in South Florida. Ron told me he had definitely established these points. Radio Cayman is operated and supported by some of the same South Florida anti-Castro groups that are involved with Radio Mambi BCS, currently being carried by WAQI 710 in Miami. These groups have been, These groups have been dissatisfied with Radio Marti, feeling that the propaganda from Voice of America has not been sufficiently hard-hitting. Castro apparently feels the same way, since he jams WAQI, but not Radio Marti, at least not very much. While Ron did not rule out some indirect CIA involvement in the financing or operation of Radio Kaiman, he was certain that the station is not a direct CIA operation like Radio 15 de Septiembre. The station is directly run by the South Florida anti-Castro groups of private citizens per Ron. He seemed confident that a Radio Kaiman QSL address would be forthcoming. He did not make it clear to me if this would be through an anti-Castro organization or via WAQI in Miami. Ron pointed out that his contacts had been unusually tight-lipped about the station and that it had taken him quite a while just to assemble these details. While most clandestines tend to be secretive by definition, their main purpose is to widely disseminate information on a political point of view. Therefore, most of them eventually become at least somewhat accessible to DXers for PR purposes, if nothing else. The unusual secrecy surrounding Radio Kaiman consequently remains a strange puzzle. It seems clear that while Ron had uncovered some very interesting and important new info, he had also only begun to scratch the surface on this station. The situation further illustrates the tremendous void that Ron's death has created. This is from George Zeller, the ACE of September. Continuing, it was my sad duty to inform the DX world of Ron's death on July 25th. This would be July 25th of 1987. It seems to have been of natural causes, in his sleep. It took a month for the coroner's report to be completed, which gave the cause of death as chronic alcoholism. This came as a surprise to me, as I knew him well, had traveled with him both in the U.S. and abroad, and had never seen him inebriated or overindulging. As a result of his involvement in sensitive U.S. and Cuban government affairs, he was under increasing pressure the last few years, possibly resulting in this abrupt end to a good friend and greatly respected colleague. I do not think this information demeans him. Alcoholism is a disease. Yeah, that from Glenn Hauser. So is fascism. Rest in peace, Ron Schatz. Tough luck, partner. Next time, know where to stick your nose if there is a such thing as reincarnation. But as we all know, there's no such thing as a conspiracy. The CIA does not commit assassinations. There are no American political assassinations, and everything is just hunky-dory. In stark witness to that, the following story from that, again, this is a downloading, or almost random downloading, of articles from the past 8 years from my minor assassinations or suspicious deaths file. From the San Jose Mercury of Friday, February 19th of 1982, this is by Ed Herring, a staff writer for the Mercury, there's no mystery in hit-and-run death of former CIA agent, officials say. For a while, ex-agent's death was suspicious. For a while, the hit-and-run death of former CIA agent Edward Ellis Smith had officials in Redwood City wondering what they had on their hands. Smith, 60, was run down on rain-slick El Camino Real just after midnight Saturday. He was dead at the scene. In the dead man's briefcase were handwritten notes about the Soviet spy agency, the KGB, and about the CIA. His employer said that because of Smith's background, he first believed Smith had been murdered. He since has changed his mind. Redwood City police, too, are convinced it was not a murder. They say a man has come forward and admitted driving the car. The police will not identify the man until formal charges are filed. It was not a glamorous end for a man whose work took him to foreign capitals on many secret missions. In addition to having worked for the CIA, Smith was a former Army and State Department intelligence officer assigned to the Moscow Embassy during the Cold War years. He also had written a book for the Hoover Institution at Stanford University about the Russian secret police. Recently, Smith, who had been living in Palo Alto, worked for a San Francisco brokerage firm where he helped publish a monthly newsletter on international economics. David Smith, no relation, is a partner in that firm, Smith Bellingham International. The broker said Smith listed his past occupation only as U.S. foreign officer on his resume, but David Smith said flatly, he was with the CIA, unquote. Smith did not go so far as to describe his employee as a spy, but he said Smith told him he had been involved in undercover intelligence work in Russia. David Smith said he was not aware of whether Edward Ellis Smith had remained active with the CIA after his official retirement. Smith's connection with the CIA would not be confirmed or denied by the agency. Kathy Ferson, with the Public Affairs Office at CIA headquarters in McLean, Virginia, said Thursday that late agents cannot be identified without written permission from a relative. David Smith described the victim as a man with a brilliant mind and scholarly personality. He was an awfully nice guy, not what you'd expect of a CIA agent, Smith said. He was just a tremendous gentleman. He was just a wealth of knowledge, unquote. The broker said Smith was about 5'8" and slightly portly. He always wore business suits. David Smith said a lot of information, unquote, in the brokerage newsletter came out of the Kremlin from sources Edward Ellis Smith had cultivated while in Russia. David Smith and John Gunn, a Palo Alto attorney who knew the victim, said Edward Ellis Smith was working on another book, and they believe the notes he carried were for its research. Samuel Adams was about to have a book published, too. Often, people who were writing very important and controversial books die under strange circumstances, either just before or just after the publication. It's one of the things one learns to watch. Of course, agents who, for one reason or another, run afoul of the national security establishment are done in with staggering regularity. The long hit parade pursuant to the Iran-Contra scandal will serve as witness to that for those people who are skeptical of some of the things I'm talking about here this evening. Again, if you tuned in for one of the first times, stick with us and see if a lot of this stuff doesn't make a lot more sense after a period of time. Interesting plane crash reported in the San Jose Mercury of Monday, March 22nd of 1982. An AP story out of Calexico or Calihico, Mexico, headlined, Mexican officials investigate plane crash that killed seven. Authorities in Mexico were trying to determine Sunday what caused a plane crash in which six California residents and one Mexican resident died. Searchers on Saturday spotted the wreckage about halfway between Mexicali and Hermosillo, Mexico, 110 miles southeast of the border city of Calihico, said Kern County Sheriff's Captain Gary Baker. The investigation will be handled by the Mexican authorities, unquote, Kern County Sheriff's Lieutenant Al Gutierrez said. The pilot was identified as 59-year-old Elmo Belwamini of Buttonwillow, a businessman and farmer. He was a partner in his family's extensive Buttonwillow farms and a director of Bank Corporation, which owns Community First Bank of Buttonwillow. And here's the key part. Belwamini's younger brother, George, who was not in the plane, was known for reportedly helping Billy Carter to arrange oil to import from Libya for the Charter Oil Company in 1980. That last sentence. Belwamini's younger brother, George, who was not in the plane, was known for reportedly helping Billy Carter try to arrange oil to import from Libya for the Charter Oil Company in 1980. Well, the whole Billy Carter-Libyan dealings figured in a big way in terms of the sabotage of the Carter campaign, in effect probably part of the October surprise. We've taken a look at the connections between Francesco Pazienza and Arnaud de Borgrave to breaking the Billy Carter, the Billy Gates story. And one of the things that's interesting here is that the younger brother of this Belwamini fellow was a key person involved in that connection. We don't know whether Belwamini himself was, but sometimes people are done in order to send a message to relatives. The reason why this article was saved in the files, now this is March 22nd of 1982, and again, the oil was from the Charter Oil Company. There was another plane crash 4 months later. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle, actually this is a helicopter crash, the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, July 30th of 1982. A UPI story from Galway, Ireland, it's headlined, Four top officials of U.S. firm die in Ireland copter crash. The president and three other top American executives of the charter company were killed yesterday when a helicopter ferrying them from an ancient Irish castle crashed in dense fog. The pilot, who apparently lost his way, was also killed. The Americans had been attending a meeting at Ballinhainch Castle, I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, an exclusive hotel near Ireland's rugged west coast that is owned by the company's multimillionaire board chairman, Raymond Mason. The four executives were identified as Charter Company President Jack Donnell, 53, Dudley Parker, 49, Charter Oil Company President, Barry Green, 34, Charter Oil Executive Vice President, and Jay Lammons, 43, Charter Oil Senior Vice President. All except Lammons, who lived in Houston, were from Jacksonville, where Charter has its headquarters, company spokesman John Rogers said. One of their aircraft turned up missing. Tough luck. Can't win them all. One of the stories that we covered on One Step Beyond in 1981 concerned a very alarming connection to the Medfly spraying that occurred in 1981 and 82 here in the Valley. The company that was handling that spraying was Evergreen Helicopter, which in turn was a subsidiary of Evergreen Aviation. Evergreen consisted in large measure of the properties of Intermountain Aviation, which has long been identified as a CIA air proprietary, much like Southern Air Transport and Air America. The Evergreen Helicopter, interestingly enough, was the high bidder on the Medfly spraying up here in the valley. So basically, when people think about the CIA, they think about something that occurs overseas. Well, those of you who were in the valley in 1981, remember those helicopters flying back and forth? That was the CIA. In connection with that, the following article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, February 11th of 1982. This is a Chronicle story from Sacramento, headlined, high state agriculture official killed. George subheaded George Strathern in car crash. Strathearn. George W. Well, let's call him Strathern. I don't know how it's pronounced. George W. Strathern, a top official of the State Department of Food and Agriculture and one of California's most respected cattlemen, was killed Tuesday night when his car was smashed broadside by that of another driver who police said was drunk. As Chief Deputy Director, Strathern, 54, was second in command of the Agriculture Department and the liaison between that department and Governor Brown's controversial medfly eradication program. Another one bites the dust. Can't win them all. The following story was run in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, February 11th of 1982. As a matter of fact, the very same paper and the very same day as that last story. AP story, Dateline, West Palm Beach, Florida. Headline, Death of Abscam Wife Ruled Suicide. Palm Beach County authorities have determined that Cynthia Marie Weinberg took her own life despite contentions from her lawyer that she was unlikely to commit suicide. Toxicological tests released yesterday showed that Mrs. Weinberg, 50, took a few gulps of alcohol mixed with a low-grade depressant before she wrote a suicide note and hanged herself. The lady killed herself, said Sheriff's Detective Sergeant Tom Thompson. Mrs. Weinberg, estranged wife of Abscam middleman Mel Weinberg, died January 26th. She had claimed her husband lied in his testimony against defendants in the Abscam bribery cases. Lawyer Michael Dennis of Garden City, New York, disputes the coroner's findings and said he will ask State Attorney David Bloodworth to hold an official inquest. Well, the Abscam stings, as they came to be known, the Abscam case involved a lot of things more than just simple greasing of palms. Mel Weinberg himself was connected with, among other things, to the Red Brigades, the same group that Edwin Wilson helped finance, which essentially was a major element in fomenting political reaction in Italy. The Red Brigades actually having been founded by Licio Gelli, as we've talked about in Radio Free America number 19. And again, she was casting doubt on the veracity of Mel Weinberg and what he had had to say. Just goes to show you that divorced wives of FBI informants and stingmen shouldn't just hang around. Tough luck, Marie. Can't win them all. The following article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 3rd of 1980, an AP story, Dateline Paris, headline, Roman Gary Dies, Apparent Suicide. French novelist Roman Gary died last night of a gunshot wound 15 months after the tragic death of his ex-wife, American actress Jean Seberg, police reported. They said the wound, apparently, was self-inflicted. Investigators reported the body of the 66-year-old writer and film director was found in his Paris apartment with one bullet wound in the head. A relative who visited Gary a few weeks ago said he found the writer and former diplomat brooding over Seberg's death. Her naked body was found in her car September 8, 1979, and medical examiners said she died from a combination of alcohol and barbiturates. She was 44. Gary claimed she had been driven to suicide as a result of a news story planted by the FBI in 1970, indicating the movie star was pregnant by a member of the Black Panther Party. The FBI later admitted it was responsible for spreading the rumor and said it had sought to, quote, cheapen her image with the general public, unquote, because of her financial support of the Black Panthers. She an alleged suicide, Roman Gary, dead of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. So long, Roman Gary. So long, Jean Seberg. As the Red Army funerary poem that I used a couple of weeks ago said, will there be a rendezvous? I cannot say. Talked earlier in the broadcast about the tremendous numbers of deaths in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. When we update the Iran-Contra scandal, this death may well go into the food for thought and grounds for further research category. There's been a lot of discussion recently concerning the October surprise, the apparent and apparently successful effort by the Reagan campaign to keep the Iranian hostages held until after Jimmy Carter's defeat was assured. This in exchange for a promise, obviously fulfilled, to ship arms to the Iranians. A shorthand term for this entire scam, of course, is high treason. And one of the people that's been mentioned in connection with the October surprise is the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Hashemi Rafsanjani. In connection with that, from the New York Times of Saturday, January 17th of 1987, and research credit to a listener for this, this is an article by James M. Markham of the New York Times, datelined Bonn, headlined, Bonn may balk at extraditing terror suspect. I'm going to read you just this one short article. In the northern city of Hamburg, meanwhile, the former pilot of Hojat Islam Hashemi Rafsanjani, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, was killed by two gunmen after he left his daughter at a kindergarten. The slain man, Ali Akbar Mohammadi, 35 years old, fled with his plane to Iraq last summer and later sought political asylum in West Germany. One wonders perhaps what he might have known concerning an October surprise. That's obviously food for thought and grounds for further research. Equally obviously, we will hear nothing more from the late Ali Akbar Mohammadi. He is now with Allah. The San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, March 13th of 1988, carry the news of the following death, also perhaps food for thought and grounds for further research in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. In the Deaths Elsewhere section, we find the Reverend Jamie Mock Robbins, that's M-O-C-K-R-O-B-B-I-N-S, at age 32, an early leader in the Sanctuary Movement to Aid Central American Refugees, Thursday in Seattle, of cancer. In 1982, his church became the first in the Pacific Northwest to declare itself a sanctuary for refugees fleeing persecution in Central America. About 50 refugees have been sheltered at the church. The Reverend Mock Robbins spent much of the past 4 years working in Central America with schools and churches. He organized relief in 1986 for victims of the San Salvador earthquake. And it should be noted, too, that not only have Central American organizations been targeted for disruption, destabilization by the federal intelligence agencies, but in particular, the people from within the sanctuary movement were instrumental in informing Danny Sheehan and the other people at the Christic Institute about the Rex 84 martial law contingency plans, which, in my opinion, represents the single most sinister aspect of the Iran-Contra scandal. Radio Free America, numbers 31 and in particular 32, detail Rex 84. Number 32 is the main body of information for those who want to refer to the archives. Another interesting Central American-related cancer death, and again, Reverend Mock Robbins at the ripe old age of 32. So long, Reverend. It's been good to know you. It was good to know Nora Astorga, too, but she isn't around either. Witness the New York Times obituary of Monday, February 15th of 1988. This story by Wolfgang Saxon, headline: Nora Astorga, a Sandinista hero and delegate to UN, dies at 39. Nora Astorga, Nicaragua's chief delegate to the United Nations and one of her government's leading voices on the international scene, died of cancer yesterday in a Managua hospital. 39 years old, she had been one of the Sandinistas' leading guerrilla heroes in the revolution that overthrew the Somoza regime in July of 1979. A spokesman for the Nicaraguan mission to the United Nations said Ms. Astorga returned to Managua in early January because of her illness and was hospitalized Thursday. She said her deputy, Julio Icaza, had been acting in her stead. Dr. Kevin M. Cahill of New York said he had treated Ms. Astorga for breast cancer. She underwent a mastectomy in 1986, followed by chemotherapy. Bourgeois by background and style, Ms. Astorga used her Catholic upbringing and legal career as cover for her early role as a guerrilla. She was best known for an operation in 1978 in which she lured General Anastasio Somoza de Bayul's second-in-command into her bedroom, where hidden assailants killed him. Skipping down, the general also worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, American and Nicaraguan officials said. The incident loomed large when the United States refused to accept her appointment as ambassador to Washington in 1984. That'll teach her. Better not mess around with CIA-connected generals. Following story appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, January 30th of 1987. This is an AP story, Dateline Toledo, Ohio, headlined Charles DiBenedetti. Charles DiBenedetti, a history professor and scholar on the American peace movement, has died of a brain tumor at age 44. Mr. DiBenedetti, who died Tuesday at Toledo Hospital, wrote three books and several articles on the history of U.S. diplomacy and the peace movement. He drew national attention in 1982 when he uncovered a previously classified report from the CIA to former President Lyndon Johnson. The document indicated there was no communist control or foreign link to protests in the United States against the Vietnam War, but Johnson did not accept the finding. And Charles DiBenedetti won't be issuing any more findings like that, to be sure. Interesting story, interesting obituary, appeared in the New York Times of Wednesday, December 4th of 1985. The obituary for Faye Joyce, 36. The headline is, Faye Joyce, 36, is dead, ex-reporter for Times. Faye S. Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E, a former reporter for the New York Times and other newspapers, was found dead of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound Monday at her apartment at 401 West 56th Street, the police reported. She was 36 years old. Miss Joyce resigned from the Times on November 15th to become a political and general assignment reporter for the Atlanta Constitution and was to have begun work Monday in Atlanta. A police spokesman, Lieutenant Edwin LeShack, said her body was found by a building superintendent who had entered her apartment to show it to a prospective tenant. Miss Joyce, who was born in Berlin on August 11, 1949, attended Syracuse University and graduated from the Stanford, blah, blah, blah. Personal biographical information. Skipping down. Joining the New York Times in March of 1983 as a national correspondent in Atlanta, she covered a wide variety of regional and political assignments. Last year, that would have been 1984, last year she covered the presidential campaign of Senator Gary Hart and other aspects of the presidential race. More recently, she had been a member of the Times' Metropolitan staff. It's a curious obituary. Obviously, people do get depressed and they do commit suicide, but this would appear to have been a relatively upbeat point in her career, a move up for her to the Atlanta Constitution. Interesting that she had helped cover the presidential campaign the previous year. She won't be covering any more presidential campaigns. And an interesting article which appeared 20 days later in the San Jose Mercury News gave similar information about another female reporter who had covered the 1984 campaign. Now that, the article I just read you about Faye Joyce was from the New York Times of December 4th of 1985. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, December 24th of 1985, 20 days after that. AP story, Dateline Los Angeles, headline: Nancy Skelton, news reporter, S-K-E-L-T-O-N is her last name. Nancy Skelton, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, died this week of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, the coroner's office said Monday. She was 46. Skelton, who had worked for the Times since 1978, was found about 7 a.m. Sunday in the garden behind the garage of her home in the suburban San Fernando Valley community of Sherman Oaks, said coroner spokesman Bill Gold. She died of a gunshot wound in her head, and the death was ruled a suicide, Gold said. A neighbor had called police, he said. For the Times, Skelton covered Mayor Tom Bradley's unsuccessful race for governor in 1982 and the Reverend Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign in 1984. Struck me as very similar to the... Not only was she obviously covering the Democratic presidential aspirations of people in 1984, she died in unnervingly similar fashion to the way Faye Joyce died about 3 weeks earlier. And again, all of this goes into the category of food for thought and grounds for further research, but I think you'd have to be a complete nitwit not to recognize that although some of these killings may be... some of these deaths may be natural, that it certainly this is a very sinister picture. A very sinister portrait of the world that you are, the society that we are living in, and the society that people are creating about them every day as they continue to ignore the obvious. And again, I would be the first to admit that buried within these files there may be some legitimate deaths, I guess you could say. But again, I think a person, particularly a veteran listener to these broadcasts, would have to be a complete numbskull not to get the general message. Here's one for the feminists in the audience. This from the San Francisco Examiner. The San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle for January 19th of 1986. This is an Examiner story by Elizabeth Fernandez of the Examiner staff. Dateline San Diego, headlined, Woman Slaying Cut Short a Life of Limitless Potential. Skipping down, this is the account of the murder of Wendy Cheek. Wendy Cheek's body was found December 14th near Crystal Springs Reservoir. Wendy Cheek's body was found December 14th near Crystal Springs Reservoir. San Mateo County Police believe she was killed December 12th. Her parents say she was planning to attend a political fundraiser that night near Clayton and Ashbury Streets and parked her Le Car half a block away right in front of Fairbanks' apartment. Fairbanks is the fellow who was convicted in her murder. Skipping down on the story, on a scholarship at Swarthmore, an elite college 30 miles outside Philadelphia, Wendy became committed to women's issues and created her own major on the subject. On campus, she helped launch a coffee house and a women's center. She said one time, Pamela said, that one of the things she wanted to do in life was to ameliorate women's second-class status in life. Pamela was her sister. Well, she struck a blow for equality. Faye Joyce and Nancy Skelton and Wendy Cheeks are equal to Samuel Adams and Charles de Benedetti and the other people. Equality is truly a marvelous thing.